sahanavavatu, sahanau punaktu, sahavirjankaravavahai, tejasvinavadetamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. Verse 78. Yadyevam kintatashrinu, yadyevam kintatashrinu, purnanandaikarupena, purnanandaikarupena, pratyak bodho vatishtate, pratyak bodho vatishtate. Tet artasya cha paroksyam yadi evam kim tataha shrinu. Purna ananda eka rupena pratyak bodhaha avatishtate. In the previous verse, this verse actually is a continuation of the previous verse, so let's just review the previous verse. It says, having spent so much time revealing the nature of the Mahavakya, so we're still going on talking about the nature of the Mahavakya, that thou art. Okay? So in the previous verse, having talked about the Mahavakya, where the nature of the individual at the pratyekbodha as pure consciousness is revealed and the limitless nature of Brahman is revealed as the self of Ishwara, and that identity is brought about. Then in that verse 77, he says, ittam anyonya tadatmya pratipattihi yada bhavet. Says, when the knowledge of that mutual identity takes place, the anyonya tadatmya. Tadatmya means the actual identity of two things. Anyonya means mutual. Means this conscious being that I am, the pratyekbodha, this inner conscious being, is Brahman, is the self which is infinite, which is the self of the whole creation. And the infinite self, Brahman, which is the self of the whole creation, that Brahman is this conscious being. That's what they mean by anyonya. It's not that I'm a part of the conscious being of Brahman. And so I'm included in Brahman, but Brahman is bigger than me. So that's why they say mutual. So I am Brahman and Brahman is me. So one without a second. So I am Brahman. Brahman is the self. So when this pratipatti means this revelation, when this is recognized, when this knowledge takes place, it says, tada, then what? The abrahmatvam of the meaning of the word tvam, the not being Brahman, the state of not being Brahman, of this Atma, of this self not being infinite, abrahmatvam, the unnegates. So the state of not being Brahman, not being the self, which is the very truth of the whole creation, that is vyavarteta. That's something that is eliminated, is negated. So no longer does this tvampada, tvam, the word tvam means you. For those who remember the Mahavakya, tat, tvam, asi. Tvam is you. So you are that. So the ajnani, the one who doesn't have self-knowledge, is going to take the you. If I say you are that, initially you take the you, this conscious being that you are, to be one with the tadahatmya, right? The tadatmya, this identity, is with the body, the mind, the sense organs, and so I become a limited being. This is the result of ajnanam. The conscious self that I am is taken to be one of this body, mind, sense organs. When the Mahavakya, when the teaching methodology has taken place, which resolves in the Mahavakya tattvamasi, that limited Todd Ottmey that limited identity with the body, mind, sense organs has been removed. And so the conscious being that you are is now recognized in its own right as being free from those limitations. So no longer is the limited sense of, is the self considered taken to be limited in the form of the body, the mind, the sense organs, everything that can act as an upadi, as a limiting adjunct to the self. So the now the abrahmatvam, the not being Brahman, for the atma, for the tvam, what you mean by the word tvam, is eliminated. Now if you say what you mean by the word tvam, you will say it another way, what I mean by the word I. The ahankara, what I mean, the I notion, when you say I, your I thought. So look at the ahankara as just what some will translate as the ego. Let's just say the I thought. The ahankara is usually lands upon the conscious being superimposed on the body, mind, sense organs. And so you take yourself not to be Brahman, you take yourself to be the upadis. Right? So you take yourself to be a limited being. When that teaching methodology one by one removes the upadis from your point of identification, then the conscious being that you are is recognized in its own right, free of those upadis. And the limiting factors are no longer limiting you. And so yourself is recognized as Brahman, as being limitless, like we were doing in the meditation. You recognize your being as being not contained by anything, not limited or changed by anything, having no boundaries in any way. And so in that recognition, the abrahmatvam is removed. And then he says, not only that, for now for our verse, and tadarthasya cha paroksham, and the being away, paroksham means being indirect, being away from my sense perception, away from me. That paroksham of the meaning of the word tat in the Mahabhakya, tadartha, artha means meaning, tadarthasya paroksham, the being away of the meaning of the word tat, which means Brahman, which means Ishvara, that the Lord, or the self of the Lord, is away, something to be reached, something which is omniscient and omnipotent and definitely not me, something that is away, not knowable by me. That paroksham also vyavarteta, that goes back to the previous verse, that also is eliminated, is destroyed. So the indirect, the awayness of the tat of Ishwar, of Brahman, is destroyed, and the abrahmatvam of me is destroyed. Why? Because there's this anyonya tadatmya. I recognize that this conscious being which I am is the conscious being which is Brahman. Okay, so it says tadartasya cha paroksham. Then the question is, yadi evam. All right, if this is so, yadi means if, evam, if it's like this, so what? Kim tataha. What comes from that recognition? Right? If this knowledge takes place, kim tataha, what from that? What do I get from that? So if it's like that, then kim tataha, what do I get from that? Shrinu, listen. So that the verses are kind of terse. Okay. So you listen. It says, purna ananda ekarupena pratyek bodha avatishtate. Yourself, pratyek bodha means, bodham here, bodha means knowledge, it means consciousness, is how it's been used. Pratyek means this inner self, this conscious being. So the pratyek bodha is the atma. This conscious being that I am, avatishtate, it remains as it was before, but now it remains without the upadis as what? Purna ananda ekarupa. It remains as it is. Its rupa, it means its swarupa, its nature. Being purna, absolutely full. Purna means a word we use for infinite. It comes from pre, which means to fill up. Like if you were to take a glass and you fill the glass up with water to where it can't take another drop, that glass is full. Okay? So prayer means to be to fill. Purna is a past passive participle and means that which is filled. So it's a word that we use for the infinite, that which is filled. There's not room for anything else. Right? And so for the nature of just your being, there is its non-dual. I'm not dismissing the creation yet, but now just from the very content, the homogeneous nature of consciousness, there is nothing else there but consciousness. It is absolutely full. It doesn't have any specks of anything else. There's just one pure consciousness, which is Ananda. Now, Ananda, the word Ananda, when viewed, the word Ananda also means that which is limitless. So it's a limitless fullness, we can say. But Ananda is viewed as limitless as expressed in the mind. It's often used as Ananda. But now Ananda here, if we're looking at, if we have both Purna and Ananda, we're looking at what is the nature of this limitless fullness or limitless consciousness. What is its nature? Is it, say if you're just like when we did the meditation, when you're just kind of recognizing your own presence, this me presence, and I were to ask you, what is your presence like? Is it depressed? Is it sorrowful? Is it agitated? Is it wanting? Is it lacking? Is it whole? Is it complete? Can you make it better? These are all wonderful questions. In a state of meditation, when you've slowed everything down, and that aparokshatvam, just the presence of your being is there, your mind can say, can ask questions to itself. Let's see what this is like. What is this, my own presence like? Is it whole or complete? Can I make it better? Do I want it to change? What I want, could I improve upon it? Okay. So, because yourself is untouched, this is what we mean by aparoksha. The self, yourself, your conscious being, is self-shining. It's just simply there. Remember what I was saying? Notice all of the perceptions that are coming and going, how they don't in any way limit or get in the way of your own presence. They don't touch your own presence at all. Now, what's interesting about that, you can say, yeah, that's true. And you hear your mind is saying, yeah, that's true. And that thought, yeah, that's true, is also not limiting or touching your being. Your being abides just simply as the conscious being that you are. It changelessly abides as you are. Nothing can change it. Nothing gets in the way. All thoughts just come and go, and that remains the constant, stable. When that is so, when you recognize that your mind does not disturb the self-evident, self-shining presence of yourself, it's not disturbed in any way, your mind is the one that has the problem. But your mind is the one that has taken yourself to be itself. Your mind has taken the self to be the body. So the mind's the one that's got the problem. Now the mind can say, oh, look, I'm actually being illumined. Every thought that I have actually is something which is known. Oh, look, the conscious being which I am is not going through any modification at all, even while I'm involved in this thought process. Because the conscious being that you are is self-evident. Right? It doesn't need the mind to illuminate. Because it is there, the mind is known. Because it is there, the thought is known. And so the self doesn't go through any type of process or change at all. So therefore, the mind can, in meditation, can ask questions, can notice things about it, can say, is my presence happy or sad? What is my presence like? What is the presence like, the me like, that is illumining this thought? Is it whole? Is it complete? Can I make it different? Is it different? Can I make it different? Can I change it? Can I do anything? Can I have a thought, some sort of a dark thought to put a bag over it? Can I get rid of it in any way? Can I improve upon it? Once your being has been differentiated, the mind can ask all kinds of questions about it. That's what we call, like, it's a type of manana, really, where the mind is really, really looking at the situation, looking at its own situation, and recognizing that my presence, even like right now, that we're here, I'm talking, you're listening. Though I, of course, I'm talking and I'm seeing, but my being is stable. And you're hearing and thinking, but your being is stable. Do you recognize that? And if you recognize that, then the mind can ask things about it, like, does your being, this being that you are, do you want it to be different? Can you improve it? That's what we mean when you say no, which is the normal answer for that. You say no, that's because it's purnananda. It's complete and whole as it is. It cannot, it's not something that can be changed or improved. Nor do you want to change or improve because it's your being. You may want to change and improve the vrittis that are coming and going because some are harmonious and in harmony with your own presence, and some are opposed to your presence or dark. For jnani, it doesn't really matter because my presence doesn't become light or dark, whatever, depending upon the thoughts or the experiences. But for an ajnani, it really does matter because that superimposition is there. I'm all I take myself to be are the thoughts and the feelings and the things that I'm experiencing because there's that anyonya adhyasa, there's that mutual superimposition. I haven't recognized my stability. Ajnani is recognized, I am purnananda, I am ekaha, I am eka. Eka means I'm one without a second. There's nothing that can touch my being, and nothing that contains my being. Now, the fact that nothing contains my being, and my being, therefore it's not an object within the creation, that has huge repercussions. If my being, this conscious being that I am, is not an object in the creation, therefore not contained, I am you, I'm only one. Because your being is exactly the same. Your being is also not an object in the creation. Your being is also not contained. And so what's to make me different from you? And then we look at, so the ekaha purnananda eka. These are very, very big words. These words resolve the whole creation. Then we go into the maya. I'm not going to do all of this right now, but we go into what is actually the stuff of all of these perceptions that we have that are just coming and going and coming and going and coming and going. They have no being of their own because they come into being and go out of being. Every perception that you have, everything in the world is subject to continual change, coming into being, going out of being. It only lasts for small amounts of time. There isn't anything stable that you can find here. And every single thing that you experience also is infinitely divisible. So you can, if you go to try to find something in this creation, you can't find it. You can't find the thing because you infinitely divide it. But no matter how much you infinitely divide something, or how much you notice, oh, this thing was and now it is no more, all of the phenomena that you experience in this creation is enjoying, is taking place in one non-dual being. And so there's an existence, a being, that all of your experiences enjoy that is not coming and going. And it's that being that gives stability to the whole thing. That your being, it's your being, this being that is not something that you can objectify, and it's not something that you ever experience as changing or being touched once you see that. Once you see it, it's this being that is the stable, being of, that the entire creation enjoys. The creation has no stability, but you never experience a lack of stability. You experience everything changing, but everything changes is changing within a stable presence, and that stable presence is the purnananda eka. So what happens is that this self that I'd always taken myself to be but as a Brahma, as not Brahman, as limited, this very me that I've taken myself to be as limited, this me remains. That's an important part to this verse. This pratyek bodhaha avatishtate, it remains as is. Right? It remains as is, but the upadis have been negated. And if the upadis have been negated, it remains exactly as is, but as Purnananda Eka. Because now I realize, I simply notice that this self that has always been the stable being that I am, the me that has been present to all experiences, is not contained by any experience, is not changed by any experience. The experiences come and go, I remain. So the same self that I'd always taken myself to be, I now realize is limitless. Right? One way to, important note here, these words like limitless have been conditioned to by space. If I say limitless, I think often spatially limitless, or qualitatively limitless, or numerically limitless. When we use limitless for the nature of the self, it's not spatially limitless. Space is something that comes with the creation. If you have an imagination, space comes with the imagination, it resolves with the imagination. Space is something that exists as part of duality. Right? So this creation is made of space, air, fire, water, earth. Space is considered one of the elements. And so what gives dimension and duality and distance is space. And everything changing gives the sense of time, because we mark time through change. But all of these things exist in the objectifiable universe. Myself, consciousness, is not an object in the universe. Existence itself, existence consciousness, is not an object in the universe. I am the very being in which all of these things take place, because of which all of these things are known. And so I am not a participant in the illusion, in the maya, in the projection of this creation. My being is not a participant, it's the very self of it. It's the very substance in which this knowledge all manifests. And so the self is not something which is in any way coming and going. It doesn't have any size. We say it is limitless because there's nothing else. There's nothing getting in its way. There's nothing else to put a boundary around it. And that's why it's limitless, not because it's big or small. It's limitless because there's nothing else. And the idea of big or small or red, black, yellow, color, all of these things, tall or short, they don't apply. Those things apply to things within the creation. So limitlessness is not spatial. And what that means for you now is when you think that me, you're sitting just with yourself in your own presence. The limitlessness is not about big or small. It's that there's no dimension around you. There's no boundary around you. The big or small have no meaning. Nothing changes you. Nothing touches you. Nothing contains you. But it's not big or small or wide or tall. Think of what color is awareness? What color is existence? The words don't apply. And so that self needs to be recognized. And when you recognize, then words like Purna, Ananda, Ekaha, these words don't have any meaning really in the world. Right? You have to use these words. I mean, that we have meaning like infinite in the world, fullness, all of these words. But the experiences within duality are not the same as your being. But yet, we can use the words to point to your own presence, which is here, your own self-experience. We use these words because there's a similarity. You can make the jump. You know, we use the words because you can make the jump. Just like I'm using and going on and talking about limitless, pointing, or Purnananda, fullness, completeness, pointing. So what you would end up saying is, oh, that's why, I see why they use the word limitless to describe me. I see why they use the word purna or fullness or ananda for me. I'm the one that gives meaning. My presence is what gives meaning to the word purna, right? And then you say, oh, that's why they use this word. That works. It is true. I am completely full. There is nothing I would rather be. Or to say the beloved, or the one who is all love, or all wholeness, or totally complete, right? That is me. There's nothing more dear to me. The most dear. Use it. The most dear. Yeah, there's nothing more dear. That's why they use that. But so the words have to point to the fact of yourself, which is here, aparoksha. And so that's why it says, this pratyekbodha, the self, which is my own presence, this me, it remains, but now free from the misconceptions. I remain as I was. That's why the big revelation that the Upanishads have to give, what do you end up with is, you mean me, but this me, which makes me me, I am Brahman, I am free, this self that has always been me, I recognize this self is not going to die. This self is free. This self can't be taken away. This self is not subject to change. This self is the very self of Ishvara. I recognize that. But it's not a new self. It's I recognize that this self is that. So tat pramasi, you are that. See, the words are very profound. You, the one that you take yourself to be and have mistaken to be the body, the mind, the sense organs, all of these upadis, that you, in fact, is the very self of Ishvara. You are that. That's tatvamasi. So, you remain as you are, but recognizing now that you're not limited by the body, mind, sense organs, that your nature is Brahman, is your nature is limitless fullness. So, let's read the next verse. Evam sati mahavakyat. Evam sati mahavakyat. Paroksha jnana miryate. Paroksha jnana miryate. Yaiste sham shastra siddhanta. Yaiste sham shastra siddhanta. Vijnanam shobhate ritam. Vijnanam shobhate taram shobhate taram. Evam sati mahavakyat paroksha jnanam iriyate yaihi tesham shastra siddhanta vijnanam shobhate taram. Says evam sati, when this being so, when it is like this, when this is the reality of how the Mahavakya, how it works. Mahavakya paroksha jnanam iriyate. From the Mahavakya, indirect knowledge, paroksha jnanam, indirect knowledge, iriyate, by those who say that the Mahavakya gives indirect knowledge. By those people who say, for them, the Shastra Siddhanta Vijnanam, the vision, the Vijnana, the knowledge of the Shastra Siddhanta, Shastra is the Upanishads, the scripture. The Siddhanta is what is established by the scripture, Shastra Siddhanta. Shastra Siddhanta Vijnanam, that knowledge which is established by the scripture. For people who say that that knowledge which is revealed by the scripture is an indirect knowledge given by the Mahavakya. In other words, the knowledge that the scripture reveals is told indirectly, as is given by indirect knowledge by the Mahavakya. For those people who say that, that is really something else. He's being sarcastic. That, yes, That's amazing. He says, actually, Shobhate Tadam, he said, that is more than laughable. That is, that just shines beautifully, the sarcasm. So the idea is, and he's going to go on, so I'll just speak a little and then we'll do the next verse to make it clear. The Mahavakya says, you are that. That's the teaching. The whole Upanishads, the whole Shastra Siddhanta, the knowledge of all of the Upanishads is understood to reside in the Mahavakya. That thou art. So what are the Mahavakyas? That thou art means the jiva is Ishwara, which means the self of, how that resolves, the self of the jiva is the self of Ishwara. The Atma is Brahman. Or Aham Brahmasmi, that's another one. I am Brahman. Okay. Or Prajnanam Brahma. Brahman is consciousness. It means the Prajnanam, this consciousness that I am, is Brahman. So they're all Mahavakyas. All the Mahavakyas, what do? They reveal that the innermost nature that I am is Brahman. That's the job of the Mahavakya. Or that you can take the opposite way, that the one from whom the conscious, the sat-chit, from whom this whole creation has been born, is sustained and resolves, that sat-chit, that conscious existence from which this all whole has come, I am that. That conscious being, I am. Either way, intake. This is the Mahavakya. Now, understanding that the Mahavakya, you are that, and then you say that Mahavakya gives indirect knowledge. The Mahavakya gives indirect knowledge. So what are they really referring to? Well, Mahavakya will teach you and then you go and meditate on it and try to realize it. Right? It gives you indirect knowledge. It's like saying, the Upanishad says, you are Brahman. You are Brahman. And it goes through all of this teaching methodology to make you see that you are Brahman. And then you say that the Upanishad, that the Mahavakya is giving indirect knowledge. How can you say that? Because you are here. Yourself is already here. Yourself is already here. Is the self experience? The whole thing is the self experience, direct or indirect? Is the conscious being that you are? Is it shining or not shining? Is it self established? Is it swetta siddha or is it not? Can you say that you are not here? That's what it amounts to. Can you say that you are not here? No, I can't say that I'm not here. So the Mahavakya says, you, the one who is here, you are Brahman. How can that give you indirect knowledge? So he says, this idea is laughable. It makes no sense. And then he goes on to tell why. In a cup, takes him a few verses to do it. Okay. Astam shastrasya siddhantah. Astam shastrasya siddhantah. Yukja vakyat parokshadihi. Yukja vakyat parokshadihi. Swarga divakya vatnaivam. Swarga divakya vatnaivam. Dashamevya vicharatah. Dashamevya vicharatah. Astam shastrasya siddhantah yukya vakyat paroksha dihi. Swarga adi vakyavat na evam dashamevya vicharatah. Those who think that a Mahavakya, that a sentence, their objectors here are thinking, I don't care what logic you use, he goes like this. He says like this. Let the Shastra Siddhanta, let the Siddhanta of the Shastra, that which is established by the Shastra, whatever the Shastra that Scripture establishes, let it be whatever. But by logic, yukti, by logic, yuktya, vakyat, parokshadihi, you can only have, logically, he says, you can only have indirect knowledge from a sentence. Ivakya, a sentence, can only give you indirect knowledge. Then with that indirect knowledge, you have to go experience it. That's what they're thinking. Avakya, a sentence, only has the capacity to give you indirect knowledge. It doesn't give you direct, immediate knowledge. Like for direct, immediate knowledge, you need to have your sense, you need like sense perception. Right? That'll give you direct, immediate knowledge, not a sentence. Right? Or say you have a meditative experience, that'll give you direct, immediate knowledge, not a sentence. So I don't care what the Shastra says. Let the Shastra say whatever it says. A sentence can only give indirect knowledge. And then he gives an example. Swargadi Vakyavat. You know, like the sentences in the Vedas that give knowledge of Swarga, of all of the heaven worlds. You know, Swarga means heaven, Swarga Adi. All of the heaven worlds. And the Vedas give all kinds of Vakyas. They're all indirect knowledge, all kinds of sentences that describe heaven, that describe punya and papa and all of the karmas and all of these type of things, the reincarnation, all of these things, the devas, the devatas. This is all indirect knowledge. That's what the Vedas do. They give you indirect knowledge. And that's what a sentence can do. So, whatever you say, this is the fact that it is. Swargadi Vakyavat. Like sentences such as describing swarga, etc. Then we say, Na evam, no, it's not like this. This is not true. It says, Deshame vyabhicharataha. Because in the tenth man story, in the tenth man, vyabhicharataha, this doesn't follow. Because in the this is why the tenth man story is such a, you know, such a very important story as an example. Because the tenth man story gives direct, immediate knowledge, right? Of something. So when the 10 boys cross the river, 9 boys are, the tenth man counts only 9. Everybody knows the story. The tenth man counts only 9. Tenth man is lost. The old man has to come up and say, what's the matter? There were 10 of us. Now there's only 9. We think one is drowned in the river. The old man says, I can show you the tenth man right now. The boy says, how? We've counted so many times. And then through a teaching methodology, really, he eliminates all of the possibilities. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Pointing to the tenth man. Why could he do it? Why could those words give direct, immediate knowledge? Because the tenth man was there. The tenth man was there. And there was ignorance of the tenth man being the tenth man. But the tenth man was there, right? Because the tenth man was there, words can point out to you, you are the tenth man. After eliminating all of the things that would stop you from thinking I am the tenth man. And so the words, when the old man said, you are the tenth man, there's a revelation that takes place. Right? There's a revelation. And everything changes. Because they had all been suffering. This boy had been drowned in the river. So many problems. So much suffering. So much unhappiness. Where did it go? When you are the tenth man, you recognize that there never was a problem? Right? There's not a problem now? And there never was a problem. I thought there was a problem. Because of ignorance, tenth man ignorance. So when you are the tenth man takes place, the ajnanam, the ignorance that caused you to suffer, is removed. This is the same situation. You are already here. Like the tenth man, you are here. Your self-experience is already here. Your mind has mistaken itself and the body to be yourself. And so because of that mistake, you have become a limited being within this creation subject to birth and death. And subject to whatever whims are taking place in the body and the mind. If the mind is happy, I'm happy. If the mind is sad, I'm sad. If the mind is depressed, I'm depressed. Whatever is going on, I become that. Because there's been no differentiation. But when the teaching takes place, you are Brahman after having unfolded step by step by step to eliminate all other possibilities. That's why in the 10th man, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Now the guy has counted 9. So when he says 10, the old man says 10, he has to see it. He has to see it. There's no choice. And it's the same here. When this teaching takes place, and all of the things that can be objectified, all that comes and goes has been objectified. And the whole creation has been objectified, leaving only you. That's that pratyekbodha avatishtate, leaving only your being abiding there. Your mind has to say, ah, I am that. It sees it. I am that. How does it see it? Through the words. You have always been that. You have always been there. There's never been a time when you weren't that. There was never a time that the tenth man wasn't the tenth man in the context of the story. Right? There's never a time that you were not Brahman. But when had the mind known that? Never. It had never known it. Why? Because all of the means of knowledge that you have available to you as a jiva are meant to give you knowledge of the world. Right? Yourself has been the stable, shining presence that's the very self of all of those perceptions, the very self of all of that knowledge. So you've been the constant. Always there. But since you're always there, why wouldn't the mind say, I am that? The mind thinks I am that because the mind has never been away from it. But when it's pointed out that you can say, wait, you're the constant. The mind is coming and going, changing. The mind is objectified. You're not. You're not an object. And so that recognition takes place. So the words, the whole Upanishad, every Upanishad is designed to make tat clear, the vat clear, make twam clear, you know, and then to show, to bring them together. That's what an Upanishad is. It all centers on the Mahavakya. The Mahavakya gives direct, immediate recognition of your being. Why? Because your being is aproksha. Your being is already there to be recognized. Okay, let's stop here. We'll go into this next section next week. Take a minute. Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamudachate, Purnasya, Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vasishate, Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha. Hari Om.
Seems to me that in a lot of other spiritual circles, that space is mistaken for truth, for consciousness, that space is often equated with oneness. Do you get the...
Yes.
And it's a mistake. I think it's a mistake. It feels like a mistake to me, but I'm not sure how to talk about
it. Let me tell you why they do that. I'll tell you exactly why they do it. It's because even in the... In the Shastra, sometimes consciousness and non-duality, consciousness can be likened to space. It is all-pervasive like space. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason is that because space is the most subtle of the elements, it is all-pervasive. Mm-hmm. If we look at non-duality as having been devoid of three different types of duality, one is called Vigata Veda, where there's one species is different from another species, one set is different from another set. That's a type of duality. Then there's what we call Swajatiya. Vijatiya, Swajatiya Veda. Swajatiya means within a set there are different groups. Like if you had one set of cats, one species of cats, there's so many cats in the species. So that's a type of duality. So you've got only one set exists, but it's got many parts, many cats. Then there's what we call Swagata Veda, another type, where there's one in one member of a species, right? One member of a species. That member is only one that has many parts. Mm-hmm. Still dual. But look at now space. Space is the closest thing in this creation that we have to non-dual. Because, first of all, space is only one. There aren't two spaces. So it is one, it is a set which has only one member. Right? Because there aren't two spaces. It's its own set and it has only one member. Do you see what I mean? There are two different types of space. You can say, well, what do you mean there's room space and there's a Berkeley space and the United States space? No. Because space is pervasive to all of that. It's not divided. So space only has one member, and this one member has no parts. So two of the Vedas, space is free from two of the different types of duality. But space is not air, is not fire, is not water, is not earth. And so it's subject to that being part, being one of the different types of species. It's only one. Because it's different from air, it's different from water, it's different from... So now... If you think of it like that, when you have an imagination, for instance, space, air, fire, water, earth comes and it resolves, right? Mm-hmm. So space is one of the elements that is intrinsic to the creation. Think of the dream. Think of an imagination. Think of this creation as a whole, space, air, fire, water, earth. Without space, there's no dimension. Mm-hmm. So space is considered to be an element. For space to be consciousness or existence, space has to be the truth of everything. Space has to be water. Space has to be consciousness. Space has to be existence. Space has to be fire. Right? So I can say, for consciousness, for Satchit, consciousness is space. Consciousness is fire. Consciousness is water. Consciousness is everything that exists in duality. Duality, anything that exists within duality has no being apart from consciousness. Right? We can't say that about space. In fact, you can close your eyes And you're having an experience that's free from space. Deep sleep, you're having an experience in deep, free from space. In samadhi, you're having an experience free from space. You can never get rid of consciousness. You can never get rid of satchit. But you can easily get rid of space. And there's relative space. There's dream space. But when you're not having the dream, that space is gone. So space can come and go. And so it's subject to duality. But I actually haven't heard any of the spiritual teachings that have said that space is consciousness. You've heard that?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and especially in the students of the teachers. Like there's a...
Not in Vedanta. Are they Vedantas? Vedanta
well,
people? Or kind of quasi neo-Vedanta?
Yeah, I don't know how you would classify them, but I call them like the modern day non-dual teachers.
Yeah. But then the thing is, it's so interesting, then you have to ask them, what do they mean by non-dual? That's why I'm teaching that not at school. I'm teaching that class, non-dual perspectives in spiritual counseling.
So you're using different teachers?
No, what I do is I'm trying to make them understand what non-dual is and realize that there are many definitions out there of non-dual.
Sure.
Well, there shouldn't be.
Because it becomes just like other words, you know. The words are out there, and so you use the word, but then if you're asked to really say what the word means, then you become at a loss. Yeah, Derek?
So the jiva realizes, I realize that I'm that, and that's always there, and yet in that realization, the jiva comes with his... I come with my history of feeling separate and living in the world in a separate way, and now I know that I am that, but my habituated movements and even the way I walk will be in the world in a certain way that I'm trying to get somewhere, which will put strain, you know, which may have strained my body, and now I am that. But it still has to... This teaching teaches that the jiva still has to continue to play out and will slowly be transformed through the knowledge in the different arenas. And that's more of a surrendered state of kind of the karma starts to play out more.
I'd say more like this. Even right now, you are that, right? So nothing's going to change. It's just in that sense. I mean... The karmas that caused you to take this physical body are going to play out and take you through your whole life. They'll just go on manifesting and take you through the basic thread of your life. Now, what's going to change is how do you relate to that? How do you relate to your life and to all of the things that come before you as your life unfolds and all of your desires?
See that?
You know?
Yeah.
How do you live in this world? And what is the relation? So that really there's a lot more to this knowledge in terms of this, which we haven't really talked about tonight anyway. But this individual body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of this whole. And so what does it mean for you as an individual to be part of the whole or part of Ishvara? What does it mean in terms of your living this life? How do you live this life? And how do you fulfill your desires? How do you relate to... how do you relate to your ambitions and your desires and your needs? What are those all about?
I think that's the heart of the question. Because it's a strange experience. It's a strange... Because there's still desire and need, but they're... It doesn't really grip. It doesn't make any sense. It's more...
Well, I think that once this teaching starts unfolding in terms of the relationship of the desire and need to your own self, then you start realizing that these desires, the desires and needs that you have, prior to knowledge, your belief is that by fulfilling this particular desire, you'll become happy. And if you're unable to fulfill the desire, you'll become unhappy.
Uh-huh.
And so what that means is that for you, your well-being is dependent on getting the things that you want.
What happens after when they're still there, but there's no connection to well-being being dependent upon them?
What happens then is that you're free to pursue them without thinking that I have to be, that my wholeness is at stake. And so the desire is there and the ability to pursue, because the very karmas that brought you into this world, right, are going to play out. And so there'll be certain things that you want to do that'll be the energy to make you go from point A to point B. Or there'll be other people that are pulling you to go get you to go from point A to point B. Or the universe will just conspire to get you there. Mm-hmm. Right? Those are three basic ways that are going to push you into the next stage of your life. So we call one major way is your own desires, right? But now say you have the desire out of fullness. In other words, your ananda isn't at stake in spite of I want this. So the desire is there, but not, but what we say for the desire, the whole desire is this: I want this so that I can be happy. That's what a desire is. Or I don't want this so that I can be happy. Positive or negative, right? What about if the desire that remains for a person that has knowledge is, I want this. But if I don't have it, it's fine, because my ananda is not at stake. So I can want it, I can pursue it, because of my prarabdha. Prarabdha means the karmas that have brought me here, so I will pursue, I will be engaged, but my well-being isn't at stake. Now, what about all of the desires that you pick up from, oh, the Joneses over here have this, and they seem to be happy. So maybe I should have that too, and then I would be happy. There's all kinds of desires like that too, that really don't have anything to do with you, but you see they're happy, so maybe you could do that. Those all fall off, because they're not intrinsic to you. These are just things, they're things that have just been picked up along the way. The things that remain are the desires that really belong to you, that are part of your life, part of your prarabdha, part of your karma. And so those things, that's what keeps you going. That's what keeps life, you know, meaningful. It's the living out of your life. The only thing is that you're not at stake. It doesn't mean that you don't enjoy your desires or that life loses all its flavor. It's just that all of those flavors are there for a person who is stable, not for a person that is being ripped apart by the tides of the universe, the sukha and dukkha. See, look at, say if you say like the one more thing, say if you say, like a normal person, their life is happy, sad, happy, sad, happy, sad, happy, sad. For a jnani also, one who has self-knowledge, there's going to be happy experiences, sad experiences, happy experiences, sad experience. But where are you? For jnani, I am here. And all of these experiences are taking place. And I'm present to all of them. I experience all of them. But my identification isn't there. Because I'm the stable person that's present. And it doesn't mean that I don't have feelings or that I don't have experiences. It's just a stable person is there, right? Present to all of these experiences. It's not like, you know, say you think, oh, I have self-knowledge, now the world becomes nice. In a sense, I have self-knowledge now, so now everybody is nice to me. Everything, all the situations change. The world is, no. The world is still a pain. But how do I respond to it? You know? Pain means it's not, some things are good, some things are bad, some things are difficult. The same. But I'm stable. And my mind rests in that stability. You know? And I see this whole, I'm talking for all of us. See the whole creation. This body, mind, sense organs is part of a conscious manifest knowledge as Ishwara. And so there's something, this body, this life is part of a much greater picture. But it's not just me, a conscious bubble walking through an inert creation. it's this life itself is part and parcel of an infinite intelligence, which whose self is my innermost being, or whose self, right, the self of the whole creation is the self of every part of the creation. The conscious being that is the truth of this being is the truth of this being and truth of this being, truth of the whole. And so I see this body, mind, sense organs relaxes into the whole, taken care of by the whole. And then I live it out as long as I have this body. I engage.
You just used the word, and so this is. Wonder if you could speak for a minute to pratyek, pratyek Buddha, pratyek Atma. Why use pratyek? Why use that? It sounds so special. Oh. I mean, it's almost distancing because it's not the being; it's my innermost being. You know.
Oh, well, and why they use pratyek? Pratyek means inner. Yeah. Buddha is used for consciousness. So it's also pratyek atma, the inner self. Why do they say inner self and not just the self? Because when we do the drik drisha viveka, the seer seeing differentiation, the conscious being is first taken to be this physical body. I am this body. Then we realize the physical body is actually an object of sense perception. So the sense perception becomes the conscious being. So I must be my sense organ. So that's the point of identity. Then I realize the sense organs themselves are seen, right? The sense organs are seen. So by who? The mind. So the mind knows the sense organs, uses the sense organs. So now the mind is the point of identity. So I'm going inward in a sense. Right. Then I realize that the mind itself is known, right? By who? The self, consciousness. So when they say pratyekatma, it's just simply going to the innermost innermost being, having made into upadis, the body, the mind, the sense organs, the ahankara, all of these things. We could do without it also. But what we're saying is...
So kind of acknowledges that we this upadidom.
Yes, because now say when you say...
Getting, ditching them.
Yeah. Say when you say, you are that, with a Mahavakya. It's not, if I say you are Brahman, say for instance, or you are Ishwara, if I say that, it can't be, we can't mean you, the physical body, so we have to go inward. Can't mean the sense organs, have to go inward. Can't be the mind, no, have to go inward. Have to go to the Atma. Right? So the inner self is the self of Ishwara. The body, mind, sense organs, all that belongs in Maya, body, mind, sense organs, those are part of Ishwara, part of the whole creation. What is the? Where is the point of identity? The body is part of the whole. Mind is part of the whole. Sense organs, part of the whole. Ahankara, I thought, is the thought, part of the whole. So where's the identity? Where you say, you are that. Only from the standpoint of consciousness, the conscious being that you are. And in fact, you are the conscious being. You're not these things that are coming and going that you're aware of. So that's the Mahavakya, the recognition that that innermost conscious being that can no, not be objectified. It can be objectified, it becomes outer. So it can't be objectified as an object, but is the self-evident subject. It is that self-evident subject me that we call pratyek bodha. It is that self that is limitless, that is Brahman.
You know, one thing, this is still, you know, going, talking about whether words can give direct knowledge or not. You know, that's an interesting thing. But it's like, this is an example where people use these words like the inner self and so forth. And words are so easily misunderstood. So then I think the tendency is for people to say, well, it's not the words, it's the actual meaning of the words. So it's beyond the words are just pointing.
That's
what it's saying is, though, that it, when the words are used properly to point to something, then they actually can point directly to the knowledge. It's interesting.
But that's exactly right what you say. That the whole teaching tradition of the Upanishad is to use the words in such a way as to take the mind step by step by step to that recognition.
Right, and that's what's so unique, I think, about this teaching, because so many of the other teachings talk about, it's, don't listen to the words, it's just, you know, just try to get the sense of what I'm saying, etc., etc. You know, which has something to it as well. I mean, that can be useful, but for people who get too hung up on... But the thing is, this, you know, possibly on logical contradictions and stuff like that, but the thing that's so unique in this teaching, I think, is how, you know, that it does point, it talks about that words can actually directly show you the nature of reality.
Yeah, they can point to the nature of reality because it's aprocha. Aprocha means it's self-evident. It's self-shining.
It's itself out of them.
Yeah.
Because it's right there.
It's right there, and so the words can point. And it's not there as an object, it's there as the nature of the subject. And so, and since it is you, the words can point to it. And that's what the Upanishad is. The Upanishad is a pramana. Now, the problem is that that understanding of the Upanishads as a pramana, which is there in India in the tradition, the Shankara, that is the tradition, that has not made it over. It's made it over here, but it's also a lot of other things that come over. If the idea, the understanding of the Vedanta as a means of knowledge, means the Upanishad as a means of knowledge, the direct, immediate knowledge of the self, forgiving that, if that is missed, the pramana, then it becomes a lecture. Mm-hmm. You get the lecture and then you go to try to realize it. Mm-hmm. Because that teaching methodology is not there. And so say somebody who's has some understanding but they don't really have the teaching methodology, they'll say, well, it's kind of like this. You know, but the teaching methodology is not there to take it, to take the student to the recognition.
And it's almost like the, you know, people, the problem is that people miss that it's not something remote that you have to find somewhere else.
That's the thing.
And that's why the pramana works, is because it's actually the experience you're already having. It's right here in front of you already.
That's exactly it.
But when people say, oh, you can't get it from words, they're then actually implying that there's a distance between themselves and the truth. And that therefore they have to go do something to themselves in order to get to the truth rather than just seeing their own nature, which is already there.
Perfect. That's what it is. That's exactly it. It's so obvious when you see it.
My resistance to what you're saying is that if everything's infinitely invisible, then so is the mind, and the mind can ask questions forever, and if you feed it, then it will come up with new questions, and you're supposing that this is...
Well, but I'll tell you what's wrong with that. That is true in reference to the creation, because the creation, time, space, it's infinite. Even, you know, the Jains even say one thing that they're famous for, it's an ancient group in India. Anything within the creation, we say this in Vedanta too, and Buddhists say it, anything can be viewed from an infinite number of standpoints. You can never get to the bottom of it. Ever. It's that's what we call maya. There's no end to the inquiry.
Right.
But the Atma, the self, has no parts. There's no, you know, it is only one thing. It has no, you can't know it from the right side or the left side or up or down. Or this side or that side. It is only one non-dual thing. And so that thing can be known completely. And the mityatva, the nature of maya in general can be known completely. In this way, anything that you experience in this creation, it's subject to change, yes or no? You have to say yes. Okay. Anything in this creation that takes up space is divisible. You have to say yes, because if it takes up space, it has to be divisible, right? Because it's linear, right? Anything that, say, anything that has lengths, for instance, it's divisible. And so if it's divisible, it has parts. It's got a right side and a left side. That's enough. So that means that you can't find a thing here in the creation. Theologically, you can never come, you can't find, you can't establish the existence of anything in the creation. But say, if you forget about that, then we could at least argue about it, because it's infinitely dual. There's no end to the argument. But I can show you that it's all mithya, that it has no substance. You know, everybody will say, yeah, it has no substance. We can't establish substance. But I can also make you recognize that which is non-dual, that is nothing but existence itself, has nothing to do with duality. And that you can recognize totally, because it is only one. Right? What is only one can be recognized totally. That makes sense? There's no sides, there's no debate, there's nothing. There's only recognition.
No, I get that. But when you say, I can make you realize that there's only one, it feels like I can't get it until I'm listening and thinking about it.
Okay, but when you're listening, that's fine. When I said I can make you realize what I meant, I was talking about the teaching methodology, not me. But when you say, I get it until I start thinking about it, that means that, okay, your mind now has this question about it, right? So that question, that's what we call a doubt. So now that question has to be dealt with. Then your mind says, oh, okay. But then immediately another question comes. That's right. That question needs to be dealt with. That's why this teaching doesn't take place in 5 minutes. You know, it takes place over, you know, really a period, probably a period of years. Because the mind has to see. It has to understand. So, you know, it's not like you unfold this vision for an hour and the mind walks away and says, oh, all is well. You know, it walks away and it says, yeah, but what about this and what about this? So, and that's all, it's kind of like, well, what about me in relationship to this world? And what about all of these things, you know?
And doesn't the mind begin to recognize, oh, I am that? Like the mind also resolves into...
In the end, the mind recognizes that the very self, mm-hmm. that itself is Brahman.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that's Brahman.
And it is mithya. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the questioning is a part of it. You can't circumvent the questioning. Yeah, and I think some groups think that the mind, you have to shut down the mind. But the mind can't be shut down. How long are you going to shut it down for? Let's say, in order for me to realize, you know, I have to shut down, I have to just go beyond my mind. But your mind's not going to go beyond the mind. The mind's going to look and say, well, yeah, but what about me and what about this?
But it gets just sort of softer in its desire to know. Like it can do whatever it wants, but it just soon becomes like anything passing. And
yeah, it gets softer in its desire to know as it understands, as it knows. See, it doesn't want to know when it knows. It doesn't want to know at all because it already knows. You know?
What are you trying to say?
Well, he said the mind gets softer in its desire to know. And I said, yeah, it gets softer in its desire to know as it knows. As it understands. You know?
I think that's one of the things that's different with this, what I consider a very traditional teaching as compared to some of the more modern day teachings, which is that there's a message in some other teachings where it's like the mind can never know. The mind will never know, it can never know, it will never know.
Yeah.
But in this teaching methodology, the mind can know.
Can know.
The mind can ask questions and have answers.
That's
and
right.
It actually can. But it's a very distinct difference.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of interesting that your mind can recognize. I wonder about this. The mind can recognize yourself, but not as an object. And I don't have any problem with that. I mean, I know that's true. And sometimes I think, how is that?
Well, it's not the way you're saying it is not quite right.
Okay.
Because the self is self-evident.
Yeah.
Right? And so it is there known shining as me. Yeah. Right? The mind recognizes that it itself is an object. And that the object in the sense that the mind is itself changing and that the self is not changing. Right? But the self experience belongs to the self. The mind can comment on that. When it's pointed out, the mind recognizes, ah, my being, it never changes. That's true. It recognizes that, and it recognizes that it's an object. But what is giving, the objectified means by an object. I don't want you to think that there's a self here and an object out here.
Well, a couple of pronouns are a little mixed up. It's an object? What is the mind an object?
Yeah, the mind object means it's objectifiable, right. And it's coming and going. The self is not, it is always self-evident and changeless. The mind recognizes that. It recognizes that it itself is objectified and that the mind is constant and changeless and self-evident. And the self-evident nature of the self is its own experience. Nothing is giving it that experience. It is the experience. The me. When you say me, the me experience, nothing's giving the me experience. The whole universe disappears and the me experience remains. That's the nature of consciousness. I am that. Right? And so the mind recognizes, ah, I am that. The truth of the mind is me, the self, which is actually free of the mind and free of the whole universe.
And the recognizing is much closer than the remembering. It's much here and now.
Yeah.
Less, just not time and space almost.
Yeah, there's no time and space.
Recognizing is immediate.
Yeah. And when you recognize it, then but then there's all kinds of questions that the mind will have on this, about Maya, really. About the body, the mind, the sense organs, this Ishvara. What is all of this in reference to myself?
But right, I meant it in the sense of this whole approach of like discovering yourself, you know, realizing yourself, that kind of loaded
I think
language.
It's loaded language, but we can use that language. We just have to be careful. When all of that language, you have to be very careful, because even as this teaching takes place, you recognize, but then it takes place again, and you recognize it with a little bit more depth, a little bit more context, and you recognize again with more depth, more context. Then you start understanding Ishvara more, and the jiva is part of Ishvara. So there's many different levels of things that need to be clear, so that you can just allow this body, mind, sense organs to live its life as part of Ishvara.
And you know that when you recognize the self, they say that's when the knot of the heart is broken. You know, the Caribbean grunting.
Yeah.
But then it seems like there still can be a big identification of I am the body, mind, even if you recognize.
Well, that's why you need Nididhyasana meditation and all of that and continual Shravana. Because the samskaras is what you said initially. We're just so used to being a little individual walking through, you know, an inner creation. We're used to that. We're used to this body identification. And that body, as long as the body is there, you're going to have an identification of the body, but at the same time as the identification, because the body's enjoying consciousness, the mind is enjoying consciousness and thinking. So it's not like all of a sudden there's this body with nobody indwelling, you know, but at the same time that this body-mind identification is there, there's the recognition, the stability of yourself, which is free of all of that. See, say this is not a perfect example, but say if I have a mirror and I hold that mirror up to the sun. As long as the mirror is held up to the sun, it reflects the sun. So that mirror is going to be experiencing the reflection of the sun. As long as this body has a sukshma sharira, a subtle body, it's not a dead body, it's a living body. As long as the subtle body is there, it enjoys sentiency, consciousness. But just like the sun is not going to feel contained by the mirror. The mirror is reflecting the sun. The sun doesn't feel contained. I don't feel contained at all. And yet, this body, mind, sense organs enjoys my being, but at the same time, I'm not contained. Both are true. At the same time.
So for kind of getting more clear about like that I'm not this body, mind, you know, and all the fears and all the things that come up, associations of identifying with the body, mind, kind of habitual. So then really just Nididhyasana.
And Shravana.
That's Yeah.
Exposure, yeah. Shravana Nididhyasana. Yeah. Like when we do a meditation, you see what happens if the meditation is working for you? What is, I mean, of course it's working for me because I'm giving it to myself. But when the meditation is taking place, what are you doing? Is you slow everything down, you know, and then just have it kind of focus on this vision. So the mind can just be there and see it and appreciate it and sit in it. As opposed to when, you know, you're engaged in your daily life and the mind is busy with this and that. It doesn't have time to sit in the truth of that. So initially, Nididhyasana is always nice, but it's also very useful, you know, to break this, what we call Dehatma Buddhi. Deha means body, the self, the buddhi, that notion, commitment, that I am the body, that the self is the body. It's called Dehatma, Deha Atma Buddhi, the Dehatma Buddhi. So Nididhyasana is meant to break that Dehatma Buddhi, which is so thorough. Beginningless lifetimes, that Dehatma Buddhi has been there. You know? So it doesn't just
pop off.
Yeah. It takes time.
But then when it's ready, it does just pop off, right?
It does.
Yeah.
It does in the sense that there's, even though as long as you have a body, it's your body, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time that you say that, yourself is free. Mm-hmm. Your self experience is free at the same time. That's what I meant by this Purnananda, not being spatially. It just, you recognize the unboundedness of your being. Your being remains always the same, untouched, unbounded. It doesn't matter what's going on. You're always the same. You're always unbounded. It just has to be recognized. And the mind is so used to the identity that Nididhyasana contemplation is helpful. Done, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.